It's Wednesday, October 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm not Marty McFly, but I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, elderly Koreans from the North and South have emotional reunions. China's president is in London. Human rights groups are not happy. We hear the latest on fighting in Syria. Also ahead.
2015? I mean, we're in the future.
Back to the future is now the present day. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. Nearly 400 mostly elderly South Koreans arrived in North Korea Tuesday for long-awaited reunions with relatives that they have been separated from since the Korean War of the early 1950s. They are destined for the North Korean resort of Mount Kumgang, where the reunions will take place. This is the latest in a series of such reunions since a historic inter-Korean summit in 2000, but it's just the second one in 5 years, and only after the two sides reached an agreement in August to ease rising tensions that had pushed them to the brink of another armed conflict. There was concern that this reunion would be canceled after Pyongyang indicated it would launch a long-range rocket during the recent ruling party anniversary celebration. Troy Stangarone of the Washington-based Korea Economic Institute told VOA's Victor Beatty it's an emotional and rare experience, as these families have been separated for decades, as if a physical wall barred them from seeing their loved ones.
There's only been maybe about a dozen family reunions since the end of the Korean War. Very small number of Koreans have met or even had a chance to really interact and speak in any way with their relatives. This is sort of one of the big differences between the division with Germany, to where you had people able to travel between the two countries, call each other, you know, write letters and packages. We may have had the physical wall in the case of Germany and Berlin, but you've had a real wall between the two people. So it's very significant, especially now that, you know, some 70 years later, many of the people who had relatives are very old and are beginning to die off.
Is it too early to read the tea leaves and suggest that something may be afoot with regard to relations between the North and South?
I think at this point, it's one of those things where we have to look at it step by step. This came out as part of the agreement that ended the crisis in August. It was somewhat of a surprise, as it wasn't part of the South's initial demands, but this is essentially the first step and what Park Geun-hye, when she first came to office, had suggested should be the policy of engagement towards North Korea, which is, let's start by bringing the families back together, start rebuilding a relationship between the two countries. So I think the real key is, one, the North in the past has had a proclivity to taking cancellations at the last minute. So as long as it continues and goes through, that's a positive step. And then two, if we can make this a more normalized process. And I think if it becomes a more normalized process, then we can start talking about progress between the two countries going forward on a much different scale.
Of course, South Korea's leader, Ms. Park, was in Washington just last week. Any linkage between the two events?
I think it's important in the sense that the United States is very supportive of South Korea engaging the North. And I'm sure that President Obama and President Park talked about this and the importance of the families coming together, and that the U.S. is completely supportive of trying to take and help make that as possible. Beyond that, it's one aspect of the broader North Korea policy, I think.
Is there anything to be made of the fact that the North Korean anniversary earlier this month went by without any rocket launch or any nuclear test of any kind?
Yeah, I think this is significant for a couple of reasons. One, the North had come out and made statements that they were going to test both their missiles and their nuclear weapons. And China sent a high-level delegation to the anniversary. One would think that the Chinese are putting pressure on them to not conduct further tests. But it's significant because had that happened, it could have placed these reunions in jeopardy, which would have then set relations between the North and South back further. So I think it's significant both from a strategic level that they haven't taken and engaged in additional tests. And it's also important on the inter-Korean level that it allowed this to go forward.
The current visit is to last 3 days until Thursday. A second group of about 250 South Koreans will arrive at Mount Kumgang Saturday for another 3 days of reunions. In addition to the face-to-face reunions, thousands of other Koreans have been reunited by video. Well, the past relationships, current Reunions and the future of the Koreas is kind of the theme of the day here on International Edition. We're not turning back to the future, but to our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee. As always, she's here in Studio 22 to bring us what's buzzing online. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
What's the Twitter world saying about October 21st, 2015?
A lot. Many media outlets are sharing links to articles related to the big day. For example, Scientific American tweeted a link to a story that listed 9 devices we enjoy today that appeared in Back to the Future. Now, I don't want to give everything away, but they include a skateboard that floats in the air and cell phones. It's so strange because mobile phones are so prevalent now. But also wanted to note that Scientific American is the oldest continuously published magazine in the States. It's on Twitter at SciAm. That's S-C-I-A-M.
And, of course, we're talking about the movie Back to the Future. How many mentions are we talking about, G?
In the last 24 hours, hashtag Back to the Future was used in nearly 16,000 tweets. And it's not just American news outlets sharing articles about it either. The BBC and Australia's Sydney Morning Herald are also tweeting about the big day tomorrow. Hashtag BTTF2015 was used more than 4,000 times in the same time frame.
Well, is there a Back to the Future official account on Twitter?
There is an account with handle at Back to the Future. The description says they are the official Back to the Future source for the latest movie news and upcoming events, but the account is not verified by Twitter.
Well, maybe not just yet. What is that account tweeting?
It's retweeting about events related to the movie. They include one from the Radio City Music Hall in New York with photos from Back to the Future concert held there last week. Another example is a retweet from the Universal Pictures Home Entertainment, which advertised Back to the Future's 30th anniversary trilogy on Blu-ray. Jim?
Well, it sounds like there's no shortage of materials for the fan, and we thank you, G, for being here in the present. You can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. She also tweets for our VOA International Edition account at VOA underscore IE. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
This is VOA's International Edition. Chinese President Xi Jinping addressed Britain's parliament Tuesday during a visit that the British government is touting as an opportunity for the two countries to boost trade and investment, while human rights advocates urge questions about China's human rights record. Earlier in the day, Xi was greeted by Queen Elizabeth at Buckingham Palace during a lavish welcoming ceremony. His four-day trip also includes talks Wednesday with Prime Minister David Cameron, dinner at Cameron's country retreat, and also visits to businesses. The Prime Minister's office said this week some $46 billion worth of deals will be completed, and that Britain and China will also discuss cooperation related to the threat of terrorism and extremism. Human rights advocates are planning protests throughout Xi's visit and are calling for Cameron to address China's human rights record with the Chinese leader. Speaking with International Edition host Sarah Williams, Freedom Now Executive Director Moran Turner says her group is urging Cameron to call on China to set detained Chinese Nobel laureate Liu Xiaobo and his wife Liu Xia free.
Liu Xiaobo has been in prison since the very end of 2009, and his wife Liu Xia has been kept under house arrest since the end of 2010 when it was announced that her husband would be the recipient of that year's Nobel Peace Prize. And unfortunately, this case has gone on and on and on far longer than we expected. And it's a very clear-cut case of persecution by the Chinese government. When you look at the trial that was conducted against Liu Xiaobo, where he was accused of subversion. The evidence used against him were merely his writings, and they were not writings that were calling for the overthrow of the government. They instead were merely writings calling for democratic reform and for authorities to respect the human rights of the citizens. And for that, he received an 11-year sentence. And what we are doing now is calling on the heads of state who engaged with the Chinese government, which at this point I think includes every government certainly in the world. And we've made these calls, we've made similar calls to President Obama in the past. And on the occasion of the Chinese president's visit to the United Kingdom and to London to meet with the prime minister, it's the perfect occasion for Mr. Cameron to raise the case of Liu Xiaobo and Liu Xia and call for their release.
Now, this is occurring as it seems like all the stops are being, you know, pulled out for the Xi visit. Mr. Xi is scheduled to address Parliament. He's also going to attend a state banquet at Buckingham Palace. However, Prince Charles, who's the heir to the throne, is not going to attend that banquet. He has not said anything, I believe, publicly, but apparently he is friends with the Dalai Lama and is very concerned about the situation in Tibet. And also, I believe the opposition leader, Labour Party head Jeremy Corbyn, has said he will bring up China's human rights situation with Mr. Xi. So it seems like there's kind of a mixed reaction in Britain to Mr. Xi's visit.
Well, I think that's right. And it's not surprising because the human rights record of the Chinese government, going beyond just the case of Liu Xiaobo, is pretty dismal. And I think Prince Charles long time been aware of that. And as you mentioned, he is friends with the Dalai Lama, so he's well aware of the situation in Tibet. I applaud his move if it is indeed, because he is essentially boycotting having a formal visit with the president. And I also applaud the move by Jeremy Corbyn as well. And I hope that they do raise Liu Xiaobo's case, as I believe that they have and they will. And it's a shame, unfortunately, that the prime minister doesn't feel the same way. I mean, we certainly understand that there are a number of priorities that the United Kingdom has with China, and human rights is not necessarily at the top of that list. But the fact that the government has come out and said that it's not on any list and that they have no intentions of raising any human rights matters, and instead this is solely about business, is just simply unacceptable.
Meanwhile, thousands of Syrian villagers are fleeing their homes in the countryside south of Aleppo in the face of a government ground assault backed by Russian airstrikes, one of four major offensives mounted since Russia's military intervention in the long-running Syrian civil war. 3 weeks into the Russian air campaign, no ground assault has been launched, but government forces in a major held urban areas are still inactive. Militia commanders say they suspect the strategy of the government of President Bashar al-Assad is focused on stretching the rebels, seizing control of key highways, and encircling larger insurgent-held towns in northern Syria. In the countryside south of Aleppo, UN officials estimate about 35,000 villagers are now on the move, escaping relentless and often indiscriminate Russian bombing raids. In a conversation with International Edition host Susan Yockey, VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden says Iran is also heavily involved.
Well, Iran has been a longtime supporter of the regime of President Bashar al-Assad. And when you hear talk of Syria, it's referred to sometimes as a Russian proxy state, as a key ally of Moscow. But it's also been a key ally of the Iranian regime. And so Iran's long had an interest in propping up the government of Bashar al-Assad and trying to ensure that the Sunni rebel groups, including the likes of Jabhat al-Nusra and the Islamic State, didn't gain too much of a foothold. Iran's been there for quite some time, but of late its presence has been ramped up significantly and has become much more visible in recent weeks as the Russians have started the air campaign and increasingly bombed rebel targets in an effort to protect President Bashar al-Assad.
Well, if Iran is jumping in and Russia's using its air power to cover the Syrian government, it seems like the anti-Assad forces are really in trouble.
Well, in some ways they are, because if you look at the numbers, there are thousands of rebel forces, but there are upwards of perhaps 10,000 forces that are in some way loyal to the Syrian regime, including the Iran Revolutionary Guard Corps, which has a number of folks in there, some top military commanders, perhaps up to from several hundred to a few thousand actual troops. You also have several thousand Hezbollah fighters. Hezbollah, a terror organization funded in almost an Iranian proxy in the Middle East, with the potential of calling several thousand more in from Lebanon. And you also have what's been an ongoing effort by Iran to recruit Shia militia, Shia fighters from a variety of places, including Afghanistan, Pakistan, and notably Iraq, where they've sent in several thousand fighters to help bolster the Syrian Arab army that's loyal to President Assad.
Way national security correspondent Jeff Selden. Meanwhile, Russia and the United States have signed a deal that they hope will avoid clashes between their air forces as they fly over the skies in Syria. That according to officials from both countries. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
Well, movie fans 26 years ago filed into theaters and were treated to a sequel of a film that was out 4 years earlier that sparked the imagination of what life might be like just a couple of decades into the future. The day in that movie is here. October 21st, 2015. This is the day in the movie Back to the Future 2 when the main character Marty McFly, played by Michael J. Fox, arrives in the future from 1989. Now, many fans of the movie have been waiting for this actual day to arrive, and now that we are in the future, what did the movie get right in predicting our current life, and where did it fall a little short?
The future.
To start, the headsets worn at the dinner table resemble what we know as Google Glass and a few other competitors. Flat-screen TVs are a reality, as is video conferencing through computers and smartphones.
Hey, stop! Little girl, stop! Look, I need to borrow your hoverboard.
Where is it?
Yes, there's that matter of the hoverboard, a skateboard that floats on air, but not water, as Marty finds out when he's being chased.
Hey, McFly, you bojo!
The bus don't work on water!
Unless you've got power!
By the way, car company Lexus recently introduced a hoverboard that utilizes magnets and superconductors to defy gravity. It even emits steam due to the science behind the superconductors at work. The Lexus model won't be for sale, though, but this development does lay the groundwork for future hoverboard technology to eventually become a reality. Flying cars? Not even the fancy DeLorean that brought Marty to 2015 is off the ground today, although there are some manufacturers now vying to develop cars with wings.
This is a video game!
My dad taught me about these.
It is wild gunman.
How do you play this thing?
I'll show you, kid. I'm a crack shot at this.
You have to use your hands? That's like a baby's toy.
In a humorous moment, Marty saunters over to show some young kids how to play an ancient video game. Until they totally diss his skills. Perhaps there's a local arcade near you that features vintage games you could pump some quarters into and give it a try. One of the boldest predictions from the movie, the Chicago Cubs beat a team from Miami to win baseball's World Series for the first time in more than a century. You know, in 1989, there wasn't even a team in Miami, as there is now. And the Cubs are in baseball's playoffs right now, close to reaching the World Series. We'll have to wait for that to play out and see if Back to the Future got that right. Back to the Future 2 is indeed back. It's in theaters today to mark the occasion. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Along with Back to the Future 2, another popular movie from decades ago has a new installment. Star Wars is back with The Force Awakens. And on this October 21st, we say happy birthday to Carrie Fisher, who we know as Princess Leia from the original Star Wars trilogy. And a very happy birthday to all my brethren who are not Back to the Future, but have emanated from the past on this day. You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. We're also on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Carl Starling. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thanks for joining us and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In a ceremony attended by U.S. Ambassador Eunice Reddick and Deputy Minister Kafa Rekiatu Christel-Jaku, the governments of the United States and Niger officially signed the Security Governance Initiative Joint Country Action Plan on October 9th. The Security Governance Initiative, or SGI, represents a comprehensive approach to improving security sector governance and was launched last year with six partner countries, Ghana, Kenya, Mali, Niger, Nigeria, and Tunisia. SGI will focus on civilian and military security institutions and the ministerial functions that provide state oversight of the security sector. SGI programs will differ in each country, reflecting specific partner country challenges, goals, and objectives. The SGI approach is based on partnership and joint analysis of the opportunities and challenges governments face and entails whole-of-government strategies to achieve catalytic and systematic reform in specific areas of focus related to the functioning of civilian and military institutions. Through the SGI, Nigerian and U.S. experts have worked together to develop a Joint Country Action Plan, or JCAP. The JCAP is a shared document that outlines a roadmap for a successful partnership under the SGI and identifies three focus areas: developing a national security review and strategic framework, aligning existing human and material resources more efficiently to address short and long-term security needs, and external communications. SGI is a distinctive approach. Its key goals and objectives are to increase partner nation capacity to meet citizen security needs, prevent or mitigate instability and conflict and counter terrorist activities and their enabling environments, promote democratic governance, rule of law, respect for human rights, and long-term economic development, and deepen the impact of U.S. investments in countries that show leadership and political will to make reforms and policy decisions necessary to improve security sector governance. Following the signing of this important document, the governments of the United States and Niger began developing activities to support efforts in the three focus areas. SGI teams will be visiting Niger later in October and in late November to begin this engagement. Niger and other African nations in the region face new security challenges. The United States is proud to work with its partner, Niger, to help meet these challenges and to meet the security needs of the people of Niger.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.